This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for coming out tonight for Double Take 21. As you might guess, there have been 20 double takes before this one tonight. We've been doing them since 2010 with the leadership and direction of Albert Mobilio, who puts these together for us. I want to say thank you very much to Cabinet for hosting us tonight, and thank you very much to Poets House for recommending two of our readers tonight, Nicole Chante and Wo Chan. We normally would have these events at Apex Art in our space in Tribeca. For those of you who don't know, we're a nonprofit arts organization. We've been in Tribeca for over 21 years. But we can't have this event there tonight because of our current exhibition takes up too much space. Our current exhibition is Outlaw Glass. Features really interesting and diverse types of glass marijuana pipes. And we'd really like you to come check it out sometime. If you're interested in learning about microdosing and marijuana, we have a really great event coming up on April 29th. Around 4:30 p.m., we'll have Jenna Min will be talking about the different effects and positive effects of microdosing, and we'll be learning about how to microdose or how to learn about microdosing with bitters or through bitters. So we hope you can come check us out and come see Outlaw Glass before it closes on May 27th. And without further ado, Albert, I'll have you introduce Double Take. Thank you.
Good evening. Welcome all. Shouldn't that microdosing event be scheduled for 4:20? Double Take 21. There have been 20 of these at 6 readers a shot. That's 120 people who have come and participated in this exercise, and I've seen them all, and they've been a lot of fun, and we'll see what goes down this evening. The idea for this series came out of an exercise that I used to do in a writing class where I would have students exchange photographs, actual photographs. So you know that was a long time ago. And they would each write about the photograph that they had given to someone else and the one that had been given to them. And it was an exercise in exploring subjectivity and exploring knowledge. If someone else gives you a photo of something going on in their backyard, you have no idea what that is. And I would ask them to write about that and speculate. And it always seemed to come out in somewhat fascinating ways, the way in which people's awareness of what was going on and contributed to some interesting speculation, and just as importantly, their in any event, it worked out in an interesting way. So what people are presenting tonight, they've written for this evening. It's original work, unlike many reading series in the city where you go and someone reads from their new book, which is something I just did last night. So I'm not putting that down. But this is different. It is different. So I'm going to, we have 6 great readers, Wo Chan, Nicole Chante, Idra Novi, Alex Marr, Leonard Schwartz, Zora Said. And you have the sheets with their bios. I will not be reading bios, but I am going to introduce our first pair, and that's Wo Chan and Nicole Chante.
Hi, I'm Wo Chan, and I'm paired with Nicole Chante. Originally, we were going to get married tonight in front of you all as this performance piece, and then we realized that weddings particularly take a lot of planning and a lot of commitment that we did not have. So instead, we talked about our similarities and both talked about our experiences with depression and being performers in the city. I'm a nightlife person. I perform drag around Brooklyn mostly around Brooklyn. So I do have a couple shows coming up. So this is a busy weekend, but I made this PowerPoint, and our collaboration is called Acting Sad. And I'm going to be reading about Chopped, which is my favorite TV show, especially when I'm depressed. And I guess something you need to know about me is that I grew up in a Chinese restaurant. Is the microphone picking me up?
Yeah.
Cool. Okay, so I guess we can start the PowerPoint, and I'll just read through. Thank you. What makes you possible? In its premiere, you watch Chopped at Gold's Gym, bouncing on a treadmill toward a flat screen of competitors. You're the child of a restaurant, steeped in sodium and stir-fry. Something strange now, you're burning calories on a conveyor belt powered by the other burning of prehistoric flora. Relevant because how else were you born the second time? Immigrant children fly by the prehistoric burning. It's boring, almost. At night, you slip into bed and wait to wake at the banging of your door by your brother's fist. For the next 12 hours, you stand next to your mother at the Fortune Gourmet. People eat rice, people sip cola, people drop broccoli on the carpet and flee. You were 16 then. You still had a healthy relationship with television. Darkness that is both early and late. At the 24-hour gym, clanging, clanging, somebody else's engine revs the atmosphere. Muscle and gravity. What is being forged in the next room? Stronger than you, taller than you, longer legged has been here. Somebody adjusted each machinery to not fit you. Somebody just ahead of you whose sweat smells like plain water. If this is not a metaphor for structural violence, then you are not living your life. Or if you're living your life, which part exactly is metaphorical? The month you continued to ponder suicide, you were 16 and had stopped making eye contact with your family. Your entire family living their lives around you like a river to a stone. You spent a lot of time staring at the ceiling of your mother's 98 Camry, going from home to school to restaurant to home. By April, everything started to slide in and out of metaphor. Your father shucking armfuls of garlic in gray plastic bins, the footfall of soldiers marching in paper nightgowns, 50 pounds of chicken breasts stacked in crooked towers on cardboard on ice. It's not dog meat, your brother says. And a cockroach falling on your face like a cockroach falling. This has not stopped. In college, you tried to get an Adderall prescription because you couldn't focus on your term paper about one of the Rossettis. Which one? There's a questionnaire in front of you and nothing else on the broad white table. A nervous woman with shallow nail beds pushes the form towards you. Please check all of the behaviors and symptoms that you consider problematic. Distractibility, check. Change in appetite, check. Hyperactivity, lack of motivation, check, check. Racing thoughts, check. Impulsivity, check. Boredom, check. Anxiety, worry, check, check. Sadness, check. Loneliness, check. Problems with school, check. Guilt, shame, check, check. Please provide us a list of your allergies, cats. Yesterday, you took a shit at the office so big that it refused to flush. It was a Monday. You remember your roommate once said that food is like paying rent to your body. In which case, how do you afford this? How long have you lived like this? When you yanked the lever to draw another surge of water, the turd stayed, dense and stayed once, twice, three, four, five times, unimpressed by the rush of plumbing. The clear and swirling water around a single object, so terrified of your own feces, it's patriotic, you stare into the bowl with great reverential anxiety. It is like history, private, that only the parts of you unseen have memory of its creation. What in this world is so defiant, so honest and immune to eviction that it dares you to destroy it with your own bare hands? Reading the Yelp reviews of your family's restaurant, what a mistake. Any lasting impression, the food is good, but the service is awful. Waitstaff is surly and inattentive. 23 reviews. your mother's English bandaged with smiles, your father's eyes peeking out from the kitchen, and your brother, who remains an asshole in every description. Lauren M. details in a 1-star review an argument over a delivery that he brought to her house. It's so authentic, it's painful to read. Your brother becomes angry and slams a full box of Chinese food onto her driveway. In February, the steam rises from the wet noodles on the asphalt, rising with his heavy breathing. Your brother is 32 and has spent exactly half his life delivering food. Your father lives with hypertension and no doctor. Your mother has shingles and no doctor. You have a college degree and will not go back there. Lauren M's profile has 0 friends and 1 review. After the intake therapist rejects your bid at an Adderall prescription, she informs you that you have a learning disorder. Also, it seems you have been bordering on depression for a while now. She looks so serious. How long have you been like this? You reject your first therapist when you meet her, an Asian woman who unsettles you by her likeness and academic English. As you backpedal from her office, you feel yourself standing on ice so crystal thin, it is like touching the wet of an eyeball, and beyond it is yourself, alive and clawing into contact. You tell all this to the next white woman sitting across from you in a fold-up chair. Your mother's immigration, your brother's explosive and wasted life, your father's reserved devotion to just a dream of you, your love for ball sack and white cock. She touches her wrist. It seems you have a lot of problems adjusting her wristwatch. I'll see you next Monday. Her thumb presses on the glass face. All the potatoes on the ground, you're not meant for this. The camera zooms in on your front teeth, tearing open a parcel of dried shrimp. Pink grains, nymphic, packed tight with 2,000 eyes staring out, punctuates the air between your hands. Like a boat, nostalgic, filthy, arousal assaults you in a blast of seafood. You stare at Ted Allen's mouth for so long, it begins to move. Tell me, chef, who are you competing for today? Your fingers grip around the handle of your cleaver, a deep breath. I'm competing today to honor my mother, who showed me what sacrifice and love could look like through her unforgettable cooking and life. At the word life, you tilt your head up on cue and rock your blade slowly into the heft of a red onion. Then you remember your mother's still alive. A tear slides down your face. Is it done? I guess that's a good place to end it. Thank you. Up next is Nicole Shante.
My first poem requires a trigger warning for suicide ideation. It's called The Cottage. When my roommate is away, our apartment is a cottage, somewhere on the West Coast, with floors whose creaks musically accompany the roof's steady leak after a noon rain. I practice cooking for one, rinse vegetables I've watched flourish in the garden of our living room, and tend to cannabis in the nude. The moan of the air conditioner is absolutely a breeze from the Pacific. I kiss the rim of the bottle of red wine until everything I stumble into is a loud, dirty word. She calls, and I am too busy swallowing my day to spit it back out. I wish the window into a porch with a lemonade hammock. Weave waves out of tears I've stored under my mattress, rather tears that cower amidst the fibers and springs on nights I fantasize ending breathless, lodged between the fold of my favorite pillow. Rent is a dead thing. Our curtains are still curtains, only now they hang in my cottage, where the memory of her voice vanishes with the smoke. And should today be the day I suspend my neck like the chandelier, there will be no one's arrival to ruin. The leaning bookshelf won't gasp, and the condoning chair can't call the ambulance. I will be a selfish son, setting before everyone has finished tanning. But what matters is that she won't be responsible for arranging reasons when my mother demands them, won't be the easy target, blamed for overlooking my fading, won't be the closest, the one who slept under the same shingles and didn't notice the foreshadowing luster in my smile. Here, I don't spray remnants of joy before an anticipated knock. I don't dig for language to conceal my decaying. My sorrow spills all over the cottage's carpet, and there are no keys rustling at the door to prompt the hum of the vacuum. My second poem is called, in this week's episode of Will I Leave My House? The only thing you need to know is I am a performance poet. I'm also a dance fitness instructor. I teach twerk fitness. I teach African dance fitness. I teach hip-hop. So I've worked with middle schoolers, high schoolers, and most recently senior citizens. My schedule is very busy. Okay, so in this week's episode of Will I Leave My House, I don't show up. I appear. Because black girls got a whole hashtag dedicated to this magic, and who am I to not offer all of my sparkling teeth? Laugh hard enough for somebody to ask about my tonsils. In this week's episode of Will I Leave My House, a handful of fragile teens are waiting for me to fuel their abandonment issues, and a jolly herd of senior citizens dare me to complain about anything. In this week's episode of Will I Leave My House, my taste buds are back from vacation, so I order in and wrap myself in a polyester cocoon. Night falls quicker than it bleeds. Ice cream is the best bandage. In this week's episode of Will I Leave My House, I post twerk videos I recorded last Sunday when my body felt like it was mine. I beg the internet to play along. I become somebody's hashtag goals, somebody's hashtag fitspiration. I follow the tag, and once you control your mind, you control your body. You're allowed 5 emotional minutes in a day, then you gotta be gangsta. Nobody cares, work harder. On this week's episode of Will I Leave My House, depression is trending. I write synonyms to protect myself after the parade. Cabin of blues. Pins and needles. Gutter of gloom. I find subs for my classes because I am injured. Flake on my friends because I am so sick I'm frozen. In this week's episode of Will I Leave My House, I arrive early. She's 15 minutes late. We flirt under the dim lights, over the stooped table, make plans I really hope I can keep. I want to kiss her, but I fear what promise it may whisper. In this week's episode of Will I Leave My House, I'm asked to collaborate with another poet, and I'm too busy trying to get my voice to cooperate with my bones.
Standing scared of me. plastic. My wings are made of plastic. My wings are made of plastic. My wings are made of plastic. Oh, my wings are made of. And so
Oh, where is that senior class held? Not, I know someone, a friend, who is a senior. Our next pair, Leonard Schwartz and Zora Said.
I'm Zora.
You know, we've known one another since 2001. Why didn't we think to get married as part of
We should have.
I think it's the commitment and the preparation.
Yeah, but it's a Central Asian wedding. We have to battle it out first. Physically.
Okay. Physically. Uh-oh.
Yeah. If you win.
That's why I didn't agree.
Yeah.
That's why. Yeah. So I think what we'll do is I'm going to read a first piece and. Zora has a response, and then she'll read her piece, and I have a response to Zora's. We had something about the language of resistances, the language of resistance, but we wanted it to be a surprising kind of language of resistance as well. The piece I'll begin with is entitled Released from Within the Turned-Up Cultures. Released from within the turned-up cultures, a toxin spreads through the body politic, causing the imagination to cease to propagate, the imagination of even its barest condition. Doomsday ads and hooligan optimism clog up the intersections and malls. It is we who interrupt the progress. By we, I mean all these unaccounted for graffiti and flyers. So many suns, the significant sun is lost in the glare, and where its torrent of light falls remains a mystery to us and the whole of our nation. Fact blushes as crimson as fate. Those of us who are present must not be afraid of the real and potential sorrows. She's seriously ill. The parents know it now, and all quasi-certitudes about the future must be postponed. A pillow for the head comes to represent the apex of culture and its nadir. Near a fur that glints in a moment's sun, a strange animal is sighted, dying into air. And a ladder that relies largely on feel when it comes to the question of where it should extend itself. Each rung brightly beckoning once the decision is taken. Seasonal rhythms obscure the mineral joy of rushing water, trackless waste of a world without consent, consenting again to the kinetic. Or the mind is the most cosmopolitan region of the body, except at the University of the Oblivious, where time's mask slips from off the face, revealing an idiot grin, biting down exactly on its own aspirations, self-esteem. Your life weeps inside you for the falling rain. A hermetic sack hardly seems credible. You will excuse my calling so late, she begins. But her mind has atrophied. She says nothing further. Social order sickened by a self-identification that abandons all hope of its largest organ. The skin, in shine, not in shine again, a bed in reds and blues of our violent action.
Hooligan Optimism, 1986. In the small broken garden of PS 254, we find plump, poisonous berries and smear the handball walls with obscenities in a purple stain and blame the boys. It is we who interrupt the progress by we. I mean all these unaccounted for graffiti and flyers. We are the only brown, or butterscotch, the teacher says, say butterscotch, kids in a white neighborhood, or the mind is the most cosmopolitan region of the body, but not in PS 254, where it's Paula versus the overly permed, red-faced first-grade teacher, and Zora versus the broom she keeps handing over to her. In protest, we stomp through the hallways, arm in arm, singing Whitney Houston, "How will I know if they really love us?" We don't make chorus that year. Only the four croakiest kids make it. They're white. So the school looks good for the superintendent, first grade teacher says, detangling a few strands of her perm to a crisp hair. The skin in shine, not in shine again, a bed in reds and blues of our violent action. It's me again. So this is the poem I have that Leonard wrote a response to. Let's go ahead. Just a heads up. I like fairy tales, so I write fairy tales. Feminist ones that my dad told me. In the 7th century, a young bride and groom, no more than 18, guests pirouette around them to the splendor of rhubarbs and tablas. Children keep sleep-drunk steps along with elder siblings as all celebrate deep into the night, but the bride has a secret. In the winterland of wedding bliss, she dismissed innocently the royal decree to lay brick. What bride would set aside henna'd hands, gold-decked neck and arms, and choose an apron and trowel instead? No smitten teenager would choose a silly law over love. New husband and wife share a cup of milk when soldiers trample the wedding, demand the bride report to her mandatory bricklaying. The weeping bride is taken to the top of the mountains where the little bee, Zambrak Shaw, obsessively overlooks the hulking wall. The sparkle of her dress, the tinsel tip of her veil, the embroidery at the hem, all mud-soaked. The wall building stops. Workers buzz at the sight of her, the heartbreak. Take this trowel. Let's work, sister, whispers a brother. Placate the cruel king. Pick up a brick. We will complete your portion of work. She resists. A blinding anger. Fists clenched by her side, she glares at the little bee, or Zambarak Shaw's face, and says, it's my wedding night. The pride poison king turns his face from her, a crescent moon profile and hissing skin, for showing me, he says, the white of her eyes, bury her in the wall. The night moans and wails with ghosts bricked into the wall. The workers tremble, the soldiers murmur, but the unwilling bride shakes her head. Shakes her head, turns to 100 workers standing behind, turns to the 100 workers standing frozen above the little bee. You, 100 cowards, obey his obsession, but I will not be buried in this wall. She throws the brick in her hand, then released from the spell of the little bee, the workers throw 100 more. The sun embroidered on Zambarak Shaw's silk does not save him from defiant bricks. The mustached guards do not stop the workers from burying the little bee in his own wall. After all, they are workers too. The young bride returns to her husband. Together they live until the silver of her hair overtakes the black. And not once did they think of the little bee. The wall is left incomplete, a ghost story, a hero story, a labor strike story. In the land of bone mountain, snow, and resilience, where is her name now? I will make a talisman of her name.
So my piece is entitled, If Fable is a Language of Resistance. If fable is a language of resistance, the world of animals sides with us against the powers that be, and speech overflows its limits. If fable is a language of resistance, crazy wisdom accrues to the aged as the young joust, gently joust, joust, justly, justly joust, always, of course, on horseback. If fable is a language of resistance, autonomous art is almost possible, though not quite, while one escapes a Western idea of progress in favor of the cyclical. If fable is a language of resistance, language must be able to take us out of time, however briefly. If fable is a language of resistance, the adult and the child are one, little B and Cabell Wall are here, and the refusal to build walls, and the refusal to build walls, and the refusal to build walls, and the refusal to live inside the house of the self-identical. For fable to be a language of resistance, we need to be reading Afghan fables, not Aesop's fables. If fable is a language of resistance, when in the Ramayana, Marika, a kind of monster, says to Ravana, a worse monster, a king like you of poor judgment and poor character, a slave to his passion, takes bad advice, and proposing the abduction of Sita ends up destroying his kingdom, his people, and himself, the reader on his smartphone takes heed, since Ravana does not. If fable is a language of resistance, I give the last word to Russian Obero poet Daniil Harms. Once upon a time there lived a four-legged crow. Strictly speaking, it had five legs, but that's not worth talking about. One time the four-legged crow bought itself some coffee beans and thought, so I've bought coffee, now what do I do with it? Then to make matters worse, a fox ran by. It spotted the crow and hollered to it. Hey, it yelled, you, crow. And the crow yelled back at the fox, crow yourself. And the fox yelled at the crow, you're a pig, crow. That's what you are. The crow was so insulted that it spilled the coffee. And the fox ran off. And the crow climbed down to the ground and went home on its four, or to be precise, on its five legs, to its lousy house. Thank you.
Our third and final pair of readers, Alex Marr and Idra Novi.
When we were, Alex and I were thinking about what we wanted to do for our double take, Alex suggested that we do something that was an enduring object of beauty, reading so many ugly things every day. So we started thinking about it, and then we narrowed it a little bit and thinking, who is an artist who, was overlooked for various reasons, and then in time, the sort of value and the sort of... radical nature of her work got the due that it deserved, and I suggested Ana Mendieta. And then we started swapping videos and images, and among both of us traveling all over the country, it was so fun because to just say, well, what do you think about this one and about that one? And we started sending images and videos back and forth to each other, and then we came up with two videos we're going to show you and then two still images. And then we're going to respond. I wrote a prose poem in response, and Alex is a nonfiction writer, is going to do more nonfiction investigation of her sort of response to Ana Mendieta's work. So you'll see the two videos. How should we say something about it? Ana Mendieta was a Cuban-American artist who lived... How many people know who Ana Mendieta is? Yes, everybody does. Okay, she's incredible and amazing. I remember seeing her in college, and I went to Barnard, so we saw a lot of women writers and artists that I thought was what everyone got to see and read in college. And then I was like, wow, it really truly was not the same syllabus everyone else was working off of. And so I thought everyone in the whole country was studying Ana Mendieta, and then I would bring her up and people would be like, Ana who? And I'm like, what? She's incredible. And so it's really exciting for those of you who don't know her video, to see two of them now. So she died at 36. Sort of in the case of Sylvia Plath, I think there's a lot of sometimes the details and the unresolved aspects of whether she, around her death, sort of overshadows her work. And so I think that often happens with female biography. So that's something that sort of comes up in the poem. But these were from the 70s. Your regard world, after Ana Mendieta's Siluetas. The world said, all we can see is your body, and she said, see it here, world, in an open tomb in Yagul, overtaken by flowers. The world said, women are most legible when committing acts of self-sabotage, and she said, watch these rocks of yours, demeaning world, heave and breathe as I emerge from beneath them. She said, I will carve myself out of my own hands. She said, here I am, coming out from your endless dirt world, making it give way to my knees and legs. And if a sublime inversion of death from beneath your rocks is an art world, then what's your regard worth anyway? She said, world, you are the slow smear of blood tracks down a wall. She said, here I am, unmade into tree, into sand. And the world said, please, your island is too defiant. We are not inclined to succumb to the arboreal sight of you with any kind of light. The world said, we'd like to talk about your husband. We want you simplified. And she said, go ahead and try to reduce this silhouette of fire. She said, how about I answer from behind this mustache, this beard, with blood secreting from my pores? She said, world, whether you are ready to acknowledge it or not, we are all bound to insect, specter, man to plant, to the slowest trail of hands, to blood-soaked sleeves, to these heaving, breathing rocks and the artist beneath them, who has outlasted and will outlast, who would catch the light despite you, world, would return digitized, pixelated into twigs, rocks, ash, mud, and gunpowder. 30 years of what was either her murder or not. The world said, what? It said, wait a minute. How many videos? Who is this woman again, filming her own flaming silhouette?
Hey, thank you, Idra. So my name is Alex Marr, and I'm going to respond. I'm just going to talk a little bit and then read a very short description. I wanted to respond a little bit more specifically to the way in which Ana Mendieta used her body and her performance art to talk about death and decomposition, and to really confront the way we're physically part of a cycle, right? So I think it's so striking in a culture that is so obsessed with youth, that she, as an artist at a relatively young age, was really flinging herself at, you know, the fact that she was going to be gone someday. And different elements in her work have been described as pagan in their focus, even though she was Cuban. I'm half Cuban, and the country has like a really strong Catholic history. I actually ended up spending years researching a book that involved me being very immersed in the pagan community around the country now. And for those of you who don't know what that whole movement is about, It's basically like a religious movement that is very committed to exploring witchcraft traditions. It's polytheistic. There are also very, very different ideas about your body and about death. There's no such concept as sin or guilt. Sex is seen as incredibly natural as long as you're not harming someone else. It's just a physical expression of being alive. And there is no concept of heaven or hell. You know, you don't accumulate points or lose points in this life and then go somewhere where you are then judged in some specific way. Most pagans today believe that you are possibly reincarnated, or on the other hand, maybe you go to a place called the Summerland, which is sort of this neutral parallel reality from which you can still potentially communicate with the people you used to know in this other life. And what I discovered along the way is that not being Christian, not being part of an Abrahamic tradition, pagans right now or witches are really curious to find a different way of marking their deaths. The funeral rites that we're so used to in this country have become very much about hiding the fact of our bodies once we have died, right? And it used to be before the Civil War that if your if a family member died in your house, the family would get together and strip the body, bathe the body, redress the body in fresh clothes, lay the body out, maybe in the bedroom, maybe even in the living room, and for 2 or even 3 days invite friends and family members and people from several towns away to come sit with them, spend a moment, touch that person's hand. Often the body was then put in a coffin that was built by the family members and buried on the family's property, right? And a lot of things then changed, and partly because of Christianity, partly because of capitalism. And we have for a long time had a very huge booming industry that involves putting makeup on the body, embalming the body, dressing the body in strange clothes they might not have worn while they were alive. The idea is to really remove us from the fact that we are going to deteriorate at some point. Anyway, so one of the central characters in the book that I ended up writing, she's a witch who's in her 30s and or a pagan priestess, and one of her great fantasies, and she's kind of become this sort of powerful figure in that movement, really charismatic, totally hilarious, beautiful, weird woman, very original. And one of her fantasies is that one day when she eventually dies, her coven mates and friends will lay her body out naked in a field somewhere, protected, where the animals and the insects and the vultures will come and clean her away, right? And that what will be left at the end will be her bones and her skull that will then be preserved very carefully as sort of like beautiful, powerful objects in remembrance of her to be used maybe even in some magical ceremonies by her coven. And this is her great fantasy. And I discovered that, you know, the pagan movement is almost about 1 million people all around this country right now, that this was a fantasy that a lot of Americans have right now, really to my great surprise. But it's completely illegal. There's just no way. There's just no way you could ever do this in this country. And taking home the bones of a loved one, unless they're cremated, is also completely illegal. And that struck me as so fascinating. Like, what a strange rule in a way. There must be a safe way to do this. So I started investigating what the law was and if there have ever been circumstances in this country when where someone was legally left out after death to let nature take its course, which is also known as excarnation. And I found that there's this weird exception. There's sort of a loophole, which is that there are 5 locations in this country that are forensic anthropological research centers, right? And the idea is you're scientifically researching what happens to bodies when they are left out as a way to investigate crimes. And people donate their bodies to science, sometimes specifically for this purpose. So I ended up going to the biggest location where this is done. It's in Texas, in San Marcos, Texas, which is not that far from Austin. And on many acres of ranch land, kind of embedded in the middle of a working farm, you can put in a key card and go through these gates and enter this area that scientists are using where at any given moment about 70 recently deceased Americans are laid out. And they're measured, and the progress of their decay is measured. And while I was there, it's supposed to be an anonymous process, but I learned through my research a lot of details about two particular people who were there. One was a mother of five adult children who knew that she wanted her body to be donated, and so they fulfilled that wish. And another was this guy who died in his mid-50s. He was an Iraq war vet who had been suffering very intensely from PTSD. He was a biker. And when he finally retired, he met a woman on a biker dating website somewhere in Texas. They got married, and she knew that, you know, he wasn't Christian, and he was really fascinated with science, and that, okay, this is what should happen. I should donate him. So I figured out where he was laid out only a few months after his death. So sort of in the spirit, in Ana Mendieta's spirit of confronting some of the difficult facts of our bodies in kind of a bittersweet way, I'm just going to read a description of, I call him Bill, and his widow's named Elaine. 2 months after his death, I meet Bill. He lies on his back under his cage in the rough and weedy grass, his head turned over his right shoulder, probably turned that way by the natural course of events, the flow of his bodily fluids, the movement of the large families of maggots that would have taken up residence there in his first few days outside. Right away, I notice his salt and pepper beard and his hair, long for a man, but cut blunt at the ends with a practical purpose. It's stained with his body's enzymes. The strands are now as rust-colored as the grass beneath them, the color of damp earth. While most of him has turned a golden... while most of him has thoroughly browned, the warped, wrinkly skin of his chest and his sunken abdomen have turned a golden, buttery color from their own fat. Each arm and thigh, now tough as leather, is collapsed like an accordion, and his genitals are gone. Strangely, but typical here, his feet are almost completely intact, and it seems unusually intimate, even under the circumstances, to see them bare without his knowledge, like catching a glimpse of the fleshy underside of someone's feet when they've yanked the sheets up in their sleep. The anger that defined Bill and his night terrors and the strain held in his body from years spent weaving through landmines and the necessity of sitting with his back to the wall wherever he went, all that is gone, has leaked, or so it seems, from his guts and innards through his back and his buttocks and the backs of his thighs into the grasses, and the tension of living has stunted the plant life. The only taut thing left of him now is his casing of skin, mummified by the Texas sun into a husk shaped like a man, and the shape of his skull just starting to peek out from where the skin has split open at the back of his head. The body itself, the core of it, is deflated, like all the others here, making it easy to imagine that the essential soul stuff has escaped, leaked out, or drifted upward. And maybe it has. But what becomes certain here is this, that weeks ago, the flies arrived and laid their eggs, and the maggots were hatched and began to feed, and ants and beetles arrived to feed on the larvae, and the blood decomposed, marbling the skin, and decay bloated the belly, only to puncture it. And now, 2 months into the inevitable, the remaining skin has hardened, making a shell for the continuing rot inside. I can say that I've met Bill, but this is not Bill. It is no longer him. This is the remainder of the man, the epilogue we usually cut from the hero's narrative, the precise stuff Elaine's brain does not let her imagine. But on these 16 acres in San Marcos, this process is laid out in the open, observed and annotated calmly by a rotating cast of young students, people just beginning their adult lives. In driving through 5 miles of ranch land and swiping a card to pass through the fences, you enter a world in which the naked dead are accepted and rot is all right, and the only ceremonies needed to protect us from the fact of death are those provided by science. Thanks.
That was an exceptional group of pieces and readers. I'll leave it to all of you to ponder the rich and provocative connections between the pairs and between the individual readers that I certainly was aware of. I want to thank Sina here at Apex, or excuse me, at Cabinet, Stephen at Apex Art, along with Elizabeth and Ryan, and I want to thank you all for coming out to Cabinet for another iteration of Double Take. Good evening.